We appreciate everybody getting here on a very snowy, less than ideal day. I should tell you that Justice Wright will not be participating on any of today's cases, and Justice Kelch will be participating on the briefs. With that in mind, the first case of the day is State v. James Cotton. Mr. Kramer, good morning to you. You may approach.
Please reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Matt Kramer. I am an assistant public defender with the Douglas County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellant in this matter. This case is before the Court on convictions of first-degree murder, use of a deadly weapon to commit a felony, possession of a firearm by a prohibited person, and possession of a controlled substance. These convictions were rendered by a jury on August 15th, 2016. Just procedurally, this case arises from a shooting that took place at 4301 Marcy Street in Omaha, Nebraska. Initially, my office, the Public Defender's Office, was appointed to represent the appellant in this matter. However, as of January 25th of 2016, before anything substantive had occurred on the case, Mr. Cotton, the appellant, retained private counsel in this matter. His private attorney took care of everything from that case, from that day forward. He was the attorney during the trial. Following the trial and the convictions and before sentencing on October 6, 2016, the appellant fired his private counsel. Our office, the Public Defender's Office, was reappointed in this matter, and we executed this appeal. Because trial counsel and appellate counsel are different, much of my brief and many of the assignments of errors that I brought before the Court have to do with the effectiveness of appellant's trial counsel. One of the main ones we feel is trial counsel's ineffectiveness for failure to withdraw following a conflict of interest. This conflict of interest was brought to the trial court's attention, actually, by the state, which filed a motion in limine. That motion in limine laid out some allegations, and they presented evidence to the effect that trial counsel had hired a material witness in this case to act as his receptionist. This was also documented in an Omaha World Herald article. Trial counsel had contacted the county attorney's office, sort of seeking a quid pro quo in which no one would call this material witness. Once this came to light, trial counsel suddenly no longer wanted to call this material witness, who had initially been kind of a pillar of Mr. Cotton's self-defense case. The motion in limine was heard, and trial counsel decided to maintain his position as the attorney of record, and it went forward from there. We're arguing that this was a conflict of interest.
When it went forward, what are the facts after that point?
At the motion in limine?
Yes.
So they had the introduction of evidence at trial, or at the motion in limine. The trial judge actually questioned my client, Mr. Cotton, asking him if he wanted to go forward. He said yes. The case went forward.
And what is the significance of that portion of what happened?
I understand that the argument would be perhaps that he had waived this conflict of interest by the questioning. Our position is a couple of things. One, conflict of interest is something that we believe needs to be done in writing. I think that's what the Nebraska Rules of Professional Conduct require, is that a concurrent conflict of interest be waived in writing. I think the reason for this is obvious. It's because client should be fully made aware of the situation that's going on. He's getting advice from this attorney who has the conflict of interest. In this case, the trial counsel created the conflict of interest.
Did the court question Mr. Cotton about the conflict?
They did. There's a brief back and forth, and they questioned him.
So what was Mr. Cotton not aware of in regard to the conflict?
Well, my concern is that with a conflict of interest is that he is getting advice from counsel who created the conflict himself.
Do we know what that advice was?
We do not know what that advice was.
So the record doesn't make clear what that advice, if there was any, what it was.
Exactly. But I believe that's the reason why the rules of professional conduct are asking us to have, quote, informed consent confirmed in writing when we have cases such as this. This is,
even if there had been a writing, we still wouldn't know what had prompted the writing, would we?
Depends on what the waiver of the conflict waiver is in writing. I believe that it could have said that I have fully informed my client of this, this, and this.
Assume for the moment that the writing said everything that was said in open court at the time of the hearing on the motion in limine. That we still wouldn't know what lay behind the writing, would we?
Correct. To a certain extent, we wouldn't know every single detail of what the client was informed by his counsel, but we would know for certain that at least this was fully discussed for him. My concern is that Mr. Cotton was sort of put on the spot when he was asked to make this waiver. It's not like a plea in which there's a certain number of questions that have to be asked by every judge and that you can be prepared for that, to answer that. He'd been waiting for this trial to occur for probably over a year. He was anxious to get it done. I'm not convinced by the circumstances of this that he was fully aware of this, and I believe that having it done in writing would have made that certain.
He might be able to, at a hearing such as you say, he can tell the conclusion, which is my lawyer says I got a conflict, but I'm choosing to go forward, something conclusory. But then isn't this the case, then the defendant, the client, is then put on the spot to reveal the advices that the client is receiving from his or her lawyer, which could otherwise be privileged.
I would say that this can be done without revealing privileged information, just to the extent that saying in general terms, my client has advised me that this is the situation that I have, that my client, my attorney has hired this witness, that my attorney has advised me of that. I mean, I think this can be done in general ways without actually getting to privileged communications or knowledge that Mr. Cotton was making an informed decision. I just feel that because trial counsel created this conflict and then was a part in having Mr. Cotton waive it on the record after a pretty brief colloquy, I don't feel like that is enough. A waive a concurrent conflict of interest, which is quite serious, I believe.
So, thank you. Asked another way, what is a judge to do in this situation?
I think the judge should have probably, at that point, called the hearing, had Mr. Cotton and his trial counsel come up with a written waiver saying that would spell out these things that we've kind of discussed, laying out in general terms, but more specifically than what was handled by the trial judge. Because I feel like the trial judge was kind of put on the spot as well. He had to come up with some questions and answers at that moment. I mean, he wasn't probably prepared to do that. If this had been a plea, you know, he has constitutional questions he's required to ask. In this case, typically having to ask these questions, because this was a very odd situation.
Well, maybe all these questions just demonstrate the awkwardness of going about it this way.
I would agree with that. Yes.
Was there anything in the record after the hearing on the motion in limine, up to and including the verdict of the jury, that manifested any change of mind on the part of the defendant?
No, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I've also indicated in my brief our belief that trial counsel was ineffective for failing to object to certain statements made by the prosecutor, specifically during closing arguments that we believe constituted prosecutorial misconduct. The first statement occurred during the state's rebuttal arguments, where we believe the state misstated the evidence in this case. As you all know, this case arose from a shooting that took place in a corridor or an alleyway between a house and a fence at 4301 Parsi Street. There were four people were there. Mr. Barron, the deceased, my clients, a man named Travis Babno, and also the deceased girlfriend, a woman by the name of Michaela Burnett, who happened to be watching something from a doorway. And when the shooting took place, Ms. Burnett had stated that at the last moment before the shooting, that the decedent had stepped forward towards Mr. Cotton. At this time, of course, he also had a fence string or board in his hand, and he was holding it in a threatening manner, sort of like a baseball player might hold a bat. And during her initial statements on direct, she had stated that, the decedent never moved forward. On cross-examination, she did say, actually, yes, he did move forward. Closing, they were about 16 feet apart, moved forward, therefore closing the gap between them, and that's when the shooting took place. During rebuttal, the state stated, quote, I completely disagree, and then Michaela Burnett said he moved forward, Trevor Barron. And if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. Labno didn't say that, Burnett didn't say that. This statement did misstate the facts of this case. Burnett had, in fact, said that the decedent had moved forward. I mean, this was prejudicial because this was an important part of the appellant's case. This was a self-defense case.
The prosecutor was deliberately misrepresenting what was being said, or do you think the prosecutor was being sloppy or ill-prepared in his closing argument?
I do not believe that there is any deliberateness to this. The effect, however, is the same. He says, I disagree with that she moved forward, and then he does sort of say, if I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But then immediately after that, he doubles down on his initial statements. Labno didn't say that. Burnett didn't say that.
Did the trial court give any instruction about what closing argument was or inferences made by the attorneys or anything of that nature?
The trial court did give the normal instructions before arguments. I will note, though, this happened on rebuttal, so of course trial counsel never had a chance, if he wanted to, attempt to cure this misstatement of fact.
But he addressed it in his closing argument as well, didn't he?
He addressed it initially in his closing argument. He said,
the prosecutor started the discussion.
Right.
And then the defense counsel discussed it in his closing argument.
Yes, so the prosecutor initially said, this is the way we see the case. And misstated facts in his closing. During the trial counsel's or defense attorney's closing argument, he said, no, this is actually what happened. The state, their evidence shows that Ms. Burnett did in fact say this. And then this statement came out on rebuttal, the final word of the case, which the state said, no, my defense counsel was wrong. This is what actually happened. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But this is what they said.
The witness here said gave both versions, though, right?
She did. But her final word on the matter was, in fact, that the decedent had moved forward.
So that's an issue of credibility that both sides could argue to the jury.
Well, I would say that, yes, if it had been proposed to the jury in that way, if the state had said, well, you have a witness here who said two things, and it's up to you to parse that, to believe which version of the story you believe based on where she was standing, and, her credibility towards you, that's not how it was presented to the jury. This was presented as a statement of fact. This is essentially saying that the defense attorney has gotten this case wrong. My version of the facts are correct, and that she said this. And that was damaging to the defense case. And the big part of the self-defense was this is a man who's armed with what could be a deadly weapon coming forward.
Mr. Cotton testified as well, didn't he?
He did, Your Honor.
And did he describe what he believed occurred?
Yes, he did.
And did that include Mr. Barron moving towards you?
It did. The second statement that we found troublesome took place during closing arguments. The state said, and again I quote, I thought it was unreasonable what he, the defense attorney, was talking about. It felt almost like a script. The defense attorney gives his name. I know this is emotional for you right now, James, and it was, oh, cue the quivering lip. It was, there were times when the defendant would look at Mr. Penn almost as like, what are you asking? Stay on script. We believe that this was prejudicial, was an inappropriate statement for the reason that this wasn't delivered as any kind of inference or deduction from the evidence. He was essentially stating to the jury that trial counsel and the appellant had colluded to create a fiction, to make up a story.
Do you see it as an attack on the defense counsel?
I do. I saw it as an attack on the defense counsel as in my brief. I saw it sort of akin to Barfield, where the prosecutor had said something along the lines of, you know, lie. I thought lie was printed on the back of defense attorney's
business card. There were a lot of words in Barfield.
And to me, that is similar, because essentially saying to trial counsel, or to the jury, trial counsel here is not helping lead you to the truth. He is attempting to obscure it. He is here with a quote-unquote script that, right down to the point where the prosecutor is saying that trial counsel is having appellant make facial gestures and cue the quivering lip. This wasn't anything that was in evidence. There was no deduction from the admissible evidence. This was essentially saying that they had concocted a charade. And we find that troublesome and prejudicial. And because trial counsel did not object to it, we believe that was ineffective. The third one I'd like to talk about was trial counsel's failure to request a mistrial. When one of the witnesses, Travis Lavinow, appeared at court after being declared unavailable as a witness, Mr. Lavinow was one of the four people who was at the shooting. He was involved in the facts that led up to the shooting. He had actually been the one to sort of get into an argument with the decedent. You know, Mr. Trump indicated that the decedent had possibly lit Mr. Lavinow's truck on fire at some point during the night, some hours before the shooting. So Mr. Lavinow was an important state's witness because Ms. Burnett was a girlfriend. Mr. Lavinow was here to testify as an acquaintance of appellant, so he's an important witness for the state because he was going to evidence essentially against his friend. Mr. Lavinow did not initially show up for his testimony. State asked why the declared unavailable trial counsel objected. State said unavailable, or the, excuse me, the district court said he's unavailable, and his deposition was read to the record. I believe the prosecutor utilized a law clerk to read the part of Mr. Lavinow. This went on for some time, then approximately at least 7 pages before the end of reading the deposition, word came in that Mr. Lavinow had shown up. And so things were stopped at that point. Discussions were had on the record, but outside the presence of the jury as to what should be done at this point. And our contention is that trial counsel should have at that point requested a mistrial. Trial counsel, as you see from the sessions, appeared to be a bit flustered. At this point, he said a couple things. He said, quote, "You don't have confidence of legal stance here. We have learned that's not some sort of mistrial." He also, when the judge tells him to speak up, he repeats, he thinks this might be a mistrial. He said, like, well, I don't know the status of the law in this situation. Your Honor, I appreciate my time. Thank you for your attention.
Next, that's the marker of your rebuttal time, so if you want to finish that thought you may.
I'll just briefly say that he was then, trial counsel did not seem to know what to do. After talking some crying from the state in the district court, he went forward and had a lateral testify. Lavinow was important for one major reason, saying that he did not bring a gun to the case. And one of the pillars of Appellant's self-defense case was, I didn't bring a gun here. Try that on the guns. There was no premeditation. I didn't bring a gun. Lavinow brought the gun. I grabbed it the last second when this guy was coming at me.
So, how did the jury handle that issue? Did the court question Mr. Cotton? know how to handle first degree murder cases. This isn't shoplifting. This is a very serious case. And by his own statements, trial counsel was on his death.
Thank you very much. Mr. Lewis, good morning to you.
Yeah.
testimony, but it was one version of the testimony.
Yes, both Josh Lavo and Gail Burnett during a direct examination testified that they did not see a journal bearer approach Cotton prior to the shooting. So there was two witnesses testified to that fact. And then she, Gail Burnett on her cross, acknowledged that, well, she did in fact see him set for the accused of Cotton prior to the shooting. So yes, there was evidence of that. And that part of what I said, even in addition to Gail Burnett acknowledging that there was a conflict, which is too much.
Right, bro.
Cotton himself produced, evidence regarding his nephews during some case accused, set forth in a brief. Two of the witnesses called by Cotton, Corey Johnson and Christopher Richards, testified that they were aware of Cotton's nephews, and at least with Richards. That came out on direct examination by Cox counsel during their own case accused. So to the extent there was any prejudice from that information being presented at trial, they themselves brought that out. So any prejudice that stayed to themselves was cumulative, harmless. I guess lastly, as far as the denial of the motion to suppress, we would maintain that this claim is not properly before this court because it's not. Regarding the evidence seized from the apartment, not properly before this court because his motion to suppress did not challenge that particular evidence and even add. There was no objection on Fourth Amendment grounds to the state's trying to count evidence and testify that she tested the evidence, substance on it again and tested positive. So we would maintain that issue is not properly before this court. As far as the remaining claims, I really have nothing to add unless this court has questions. Rather for the questions we ask from the judgment of the district court.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 17 seconds. Mr. Kramer.
I'll just say this.
You can have a minute.
In this case, I feel that our ineffective claims are very serious, that we as lawyers present to the public that we're going to do the best job possible for you, and that didn't happen in this case, that if actions such as what the trial counsel did in this case, which at the very least are quite irregular, are allowed to continue without anyone at some point saying this isn't wrong, you're not being effective, you shouldn't be holding yourself out as a murder one attorney, then it's going to continue to happen. And I just think if you look at what happened throughout the case, where the state is continually nudging trial counsel to do the right thing, where the district court is continually helping trial counsel to make the right motions, right, make the right objections, you just see that overall he wasn't very effective in the most serious crime that there is in the state. And for those
reasons, and this counsel was hired by Mr. Goff.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will proceed to the next case.